welcome, everyone. I very much appreciate all of you being here. This is sort of like the graveyard shift of the 18-hour Torahathon, which I'm confident that all of you have participated in the entire 18 hours. But 4:30 is hard enough as it is, especially if you've been hearing Shiurim for the last, 12 hours or 13 hours, whatever it is. So anybody who needs to conk out, hopefully quietly, so certainly feel free to do so, and no offense is taken. I also want to apologize. I don't know how long these Shiurim are scheduled to go for, but I may have to run out a few minutes early for a family obligation. Okay, I want to just preface my remarks by saying that I'm by no means an expert. I think the title of this shiur is Approaches to Change of the Baalei Mussar and of the Social Scientists. When Rabbi Schnall contacted me about giving a shiur, so I said, oh, that topic sounds great, contrasting the Baalei Mussar and psychology. I soon after realized that I was not an expert about the psychological perspectives on change, and barely an expert about the perspectives of the Baalei Mussar. So I'm not pretending to be a psychologist, but it is certainly a fascinating topic to think about how the Rambam, Rabbeinu Yonah, Chazal, how they would either be understood, what role they played, how they would contrast. What is something that is sort of taken out of those Sfarim that is seen in modern-day psychology? If you go to a therapist, if you're part of a 12-step group, so how does sort of the world of tshuva, of Chazal and the Rishonim, especially the Rambam, how does that coincide with the modern perspectives about change? And the reality is that change is really the fundamental word of anybody who lives today, who deals with any issue, who goes to any therapist, part of any 12-step group, and we're all looking to change. And the question is, again, as I pointed out before, the contrast, the comparison of the world of the Rishonim to the world of the modern-day therapist. Now, just by starting off, I should mention, maybe on an autobiographical note, a feeling that I had many, many years ago. And it was a feeling of frustration. I'm now, I guess, 20-something years older than almost all of you in this room. And when I first approached tshuva in a serious way, when I was maybe 17, 18 years old, and I thought to myself, this is just amazing. It's just unbelievable. You come to shul, and that sense of reconnecting with oneself, that sense of hischachus, that sense of really being able to change, really being able to grow. It was just this enormous sense of optimism. And then as years went on, and 17 became 27, 27 became 37, and now whatever stage of my life I'm in now, a little bit, almost 47, that feeling of you're still working on the same things, you've not progressed, how difficult change is, to really, really change a midah, to really change something that's a significant issue. And I think maybe part of the problem is many, many fold. Part of the sense of either depression or feeling of giving up that comes to the process of tshuva, the part of it is maybe a better understanding of how people change, a better understanding of lasting change, a better understanding of the nature of a problem, whether it be an addiction or anything else, or of a midah, and not just to get up one morning and say, "Okay, I'm an ish acher, I'm a changed person, and this is it. Like, this is the year after 20 years that I'm going to stop doing X, Y, and Z because I'll lose my temper." But some understanding of the process of change itself is meaningful. So I want to just, in a very, very superficial way, and by the way, just to add to that, part of the frustration that one also feels, I think there's probably only one parent here. So is this your father? Yeah. Grandfather, okay. So it is also the inability sometimes to change one's kids. At a certain point you sort of even stop trying to change your kids, but you know, you speak to your kid, you talk to your kid, and you beg your kid, you bribe your kid. You know, there's all sorts of things that you do. Every once in a while, a parent yells at their kid. You don't really sort of see effective change. So it's not even just a matter of oneself, but sort of issues of creating impactful changes in people that are in your life as well. So I want to just very superficially just mention six or seven different topics, and I encourage all of you to think more broadly and more deeply about these topics. So one topic is the process of change itself. Now, there's a school of thought in psychology. The person who made this most popular is somebody by the name of James Prochaska, who wrote a book about change, written recently, about 20 years ago. And he mentioned that the process of change really is usually multifaceted. Right? There's an entire process of a person before he actually changes, before he changes behavior. And he breaks it down into five different stages of the changing process. The first stage is what you would call, which I think in my mind is a made-up word, pre-contemplation. You know, like every language has, somebody makes up new words. We have Rav Kook. Rav Kook's constantly making up like a word that sounds really good, but you might not find it in the dictionary. So I think pre-contemplation isn't exactly a real word. And what Dr. Prochaska and others is that pre-contemplation is a person that doesn't really want to change himself. Maybe he doesn't feel the need to change, right? And we probably all know people like this, and you may be a person like this yourself. But the people in your life are telling you, you know what, you really have to fill in the blank. Stop drinking. Right? You have to stop smoking. You have to lose weight. Your temper is killing the family. You're lazy. You're late to work. And it's your boss is nagging at you. Your wife is nagging at you. Every once in a while, you have a nagging husband. It doesn't, no offense to the women here, but it's usually, you don't hear about the nagging husband as much. But your wife is telling you, you got to lose weight. And whatever, just fill in the blank of whatever the change of behavior is. And the person themselves doesn't really think that there's an issue, but, you know, for the sake of shalom bayis, shalom this, shalom that, so the person says, I'll make a change. And typically, change that comes in that original stage, the pre-contemplation, is not lasting. It doesn't really mean anything because the person themselves does not believe the necessity of it. Okay, that's stage number one. The next stage is not pre-contemplation, but contemplation. Now, what does contemplation mean? Contemplation means a person who realizes they have an issue, they realize they have an addiction, they realize they have to stop doing something or start doing something, but they're really not ready yet for that process. They're not really yet to engage in the actual change itself. To change anything is an enormous amount of work. But a person can sit, you know, a week, a year, 5 years, 10 years. If anybody here has ever been connected to, or you yourself have had a real issue, even an addiction, usually it takes many, many years of knowing there's a problem before the problem is actually addressed. So contemplation is the person knows they have a problem, but they're thinking about it, they're analyzing it, they're being the eye into themselves, they're not there yet. Then comes a stage of preparation. Preparation means you start taking measures in how to change that problem. A person smokes 2 packs a day, so they go down to, I'm going to smoke, but I'm going to wait until 10 o'clock in the morning for my first cigarette. I'm going to smoke, but I'll have a pack instead of 2 packs. So preparation is the person already is past the contemplation stage, and then he's on to the preparation stage. Namely, he's starting to work on the problem, but he's not fully engaged yet. The fourth stage is the action stage, right? You've thought about it, you've contemplated, there's pre-contemplation, you've analyzed, you've gone to a therapist, you've been meeting to yourself, you've understood the roots of the problem, you start taking measures, and now the action of the change itself. And that's, of course, an obvious stage. And then the last one is probably the most difficult. Everybody know the most difficult stage of changes? Not thinking about it, not before thinking about it, not the actual change itself, not the small measures, but Simon, what are you saying?
Maintaining it.
And anybody here who has lived with an addict before, and it could be an addict to a lot of things. It could be an addict to TV or to internet or to drinking or to sexual addictions, which is probably the most prevalent addiction in the frum community today. So they know the hardest part is not the initial change. You know, the hardest part is the maintenance of that change. Okay? Now, how would you say that this compares to perhaps the Rambam's understanding of tshuva. Pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, change, and then the maintenance afterwards. Okay? So let me read to you the Rambam. Would you say that sounds like a Jewish conception, not a Jewish conception? Okay? So let me mention to you an unbelievable machlokas Rishonim that very much plays into this issue. It's machlokas between the Rambam and the Meiri, okay? And who else do you think would be involved in machlokas Vachuva? The Rambam, the Meiri, and Rabbeinu Yonah. Okay? The Meiri says, based on the understanding of the Gemara, that this, the way that a person changes themselves, the first stage according to Meiri, anybody know what it is? The first stage is charata, right? That I regret, I think about, I assess, I analyze. The Meiri has a sefer called the Chibur HaTshuva. You do all sort of that initial work. You do a lot of the emotional, psychological work of the regret and the assessment. And then the next such stage for the Meiri is Aziva Sachet. You actually change behavior. The next step is, remember for the Meiri, would be Kabbalah lost it. It would be, I commit myself to the future, and then the last part of that, or the first part of that, would be Vidoy. Vidoy is sort of part of the process, but a little bit removed from the process. For the Meiri, the first stage is Harata, then Aziva Sachet, and then Kabbalah lost it. Anybody know how the Rambam disagrees with the Meiri? Anybody know? So Adam knows the Rambam's Mishnah Torah. The Vidoy is the first perek of the Rambam, which is fascinating. Why would the Rambam have Vidoy in the first perek? But Vidoy actually is the last stage for the Rambam, even though the Rambam devotes the entire perek Aleph in Hilchos Teshuva to Vidoy. But the Rambam says first is Aziva Sachet. The first thing you would do is change your behavior, right? You don't think about it, you don't regret it, you don't sort of look back, you don't necessarily go for therapy about it, you don't sort of think about how. And I'm not in any way minimizing this. You know, why it is that you're doing what you're doing based on the way you grew up and how your mother and your parents. No. The first thing is you do is aziva sachet. Anybody know what the Rambam says the second piece of that is? It's not clear where this is from. But he says, v'yasir b'machshavaso. You want to sort of get rid of the thought from your mind, right? And then, kabbalah la'asid, an acceptance for the future. And then only afterwards, the Rambam says, comes charata. The regret is the final stage of it. The first thing is change behavior. Get out of the behavioral pattern. And then, once that happens, then you can sort of look back regretfully on your life and maybe do sort of the more psychological, emotional component, but that has to be last. Right? Everybody hear the difference between the Rambam and the Meiri? Now, anybody know what the Rabbeinu Yonah says? Rabbeinu Yonah is fascinating. Anybody want to venture a guess? It seems like we sort of went through both options. So Rabbeinu Yonah says it depends on who the person is. If you have a person who has become, Rabbeinu Yonah wouldn't use this language, but I'll use the language, the behavior has become like addicted behavior. He's hisyatsev. He's caught in that behavior. He's tried for 10 years. He's made promises. He's put on a cigarette. He's done everything he can do. That person, charata, cannot be the first stage for that person. It just has to be aziv sachet. Stop doing it. However you have to do it. Do whatever you have to do to stop doing behavior, and then only afterwards the charata would come. If the person who's not an addict, if the person who is just has sort of a more of a minor problem, then all the other pieces, the charata can come first. Okay, everyone hear that? So it would seem to be that the machlokas we showed him is really sort of this issue, which I mentioned before from Dr. Prochazka, but it's debated by others, as to what really creates change. Is change created by the introspection, the other pieces, that then leads to meaningful change? Or is change created by changing however it is that you have to change? A support group, a this, a that, change your environment, leave a place, do whatever you have to do, and then all the other pieces sort of follow afterwards. There's a book that was written this past year by a former author for the New York Times, Charles, I don't know why my memory is going, Duhigg, everybody read this book? The Power of Habit. It's one of those books that if you see it's advertised everywhere. It's advertised in all the Jewish magazines. Well, not every Jewish, it's not in Hamodiah, but Jewish Action and like other magazines like that. And he speaks about that real change comes about through changing a habit. And with the change of a habit, so that one habit then brings about enormous other changes. Who does that sound like, by the way, just in Jewish parlance? Who's sort of made this idea famous? For them? Sounds like the Chinuch. The Chinuch says it over and over and over again. The Chinuch seems to be based on the Rambam. Acher Pa'ulos, first story about the Pa'ula. So he describes in this book about there was a lady by the name of Lisa Allen. Lisa Allen was having a very rough go of it. This happened just recently. She was about 60 pounds overweight. She was going out with a guy. Her job situation was not steady. And one day the guy comes home. He breaks up with her. At the same time, he loses her job, or she loses her job. She's a chain smoker. I mean, just a person whose life was just falling apart. So she said, you know what? I have no boyfriend. I have no job. I have no this. I have no that. I always wanted to see the pyramids. Let me go visit Cairo to the pyramids. And she's standing by the pyramids. She said, I'm coming back here next time this year, and I'm going to hike across the desert that is found behind the pyramids in Cairo. And she said, you know, if I'm going to hike across the desert, you know, the first thing I have to do, I have to stop smoking, right? She actually says that morning, just to sort of drive home how desperate her life was, she was in her hotel room, she picked up a cigarette to light, she lit it, and she realized afterwards she had lit the pen that was in the hotel. So she's sitting there smoking this burning plastic pen, and she walks out the pyramids, she says, I just have to change, you know, my life from there. So I guess if I'm going to, you know, walk across the desert, I have to stop smoking. If I'm going to stop smoking, so now that I stop smoking, I have a lot more, you know, energy. So she started running. She started running, she lost weight. She lost weight, she started dressing better, she dressed better, she got a new job, she got a new... And she came back a year later, just a completely different person, and all that came about because of the shinoi maisa of a decision to go ahead and do the action of walking across the desert. And again, I think a lot of it depends on Rabbeinu Yonah, but very much what's prevalent in 12-step programs, which we'll discuss in a few minutes, is really this. The first thing you do is stop whatever the behavior is, however you have to stop it, and then all sort of the other pieces follow through after that initial decision. Okay, that's number one. Number two is what to me is a very, very meaningful discussion found in the psychologists. We'll use the term found in Dr. Gerald Bateson, who wrote his PhD on this in 1979. And what he spoke about was first-order change versus second-order change. Right? First-order change, second-order change. What is that? What's first-order change? So first-order change would be a person who makes a change in his life, but it's just a change, and I can't emphasize this enough, at least for me personally, and maybe it's something that speaks to you as well, it's a person who just focuses on changing the behavior itself. Second order change is to change the sort of the nature of a person's life. It's to change the essence of a person's life. Okay, everyone hear that change? Now, who discusses this in rabbinic literature, this idea of a change being simply behavioral versus perhaps more total? So let me give you a sense, before we discuss that, of what we mean. Let's say anybody who's in this room, I think I know everyone in this room, and as far as I know, it doesn't apply to any of you, but you never really know what lurks in a person's closet. Right, let's say a person has a problem with anger, right? And this would probably be, you know, if you ask, you know, 100 kids in the United States, you know, what's the thing they would like to change about their parents? Some kids say everything, depends on what house you live in. I'd be afraid to ask my kids that question. Alfie, don't be tempted next time you see. You know, some kids say this, I wish my parents did that, I wish my parents would do this. But probably, you know, most of the things that kids would want changed about parents would probably be the parents' reaction to things. Anger, temper, being critical is a little different, but maybe being critical also sort of plays into the same thing as well. So let's say a parent says, okay, you know what, I'll change my temper. And what he does is that he white knuckles, right? You know what I mean by like white knuckles? You know, he sits there and his wife shoots him a look every time he's about to get angry, so he walks out of the room. They tell the story about Reb Baruch Ber. We know the Baruch Ber story? This is a great story about Reb Baruch Ber. So suppose Reb Baruch Ber had a bad temper. It's not surprising that Lav Gedolim had tempers, because to be, and the Gemara discusses, to be a certain type of person, be a person of passion, be a person of strength, be a person that can, you know, stay up 18 hours real learning. I mean, it's a certain type of person. It's not a wimpy person. Reb Moshe actually said about himself, Reb Moshe said that he had a very bad temper in his youth. He had to correct his temper. To me, that's hard to imagine. Like, you know, you sort of see the Reb Moshe that we sort of feel that we know, and to imagine that he was a person who had to work on his temper. So Reb Baruch Ber So had a very bad temper, supposedly. And every time he felt himself getting angry at his kids, he would run to the closet and he would take out a jacket. It was like the temper jacket, you know. And he would say, okay, I'm not going to get angry yet. I'll go put on my jacket first. He liked to say put on a gartel. It's no Baruch Bear is wearing... was wearing a garter. I'll put on the jacket, I'll do this, I'll button it up, and by the time sort of the jacket's on, so the temper would have already subsided. Now that happens to be great. It's always great for all of us to find sort of like a short-term solution to our problems that we need to find, but that's not a lasting solution, right? That's what you would call sort of first-order change, right? You change sort of the behavior, right? Second-order change is that you really change, you know, the person, right? So if a person had a bad temper, it's not just about saying, you know, I'm not going to get angry, but it's about finding the entire totality of a person as to why this is happening to a person. Does a person maybe not have enough genuine bitachon? Are they not a person of genuine nachas ruach? Are they not a person who has enough simcha? I mean, there's probably a whole totality of a person that you would say is the fundamental underlying issues behind why a person gets angry in the first place. And change, in a meaningful way, really is about that. Change is about changing the totality of a person, so much so that the person can't even imagine getting angry again. He's so changed fundamentally that he can't see himself, you know, grabbing his kid by his neck and shaking him, and, you know, because it's so not part of the person. That, now, who sort of discusses that almost befeirish, sort of this exact concept? So I was a good guess to say, who are the most famous Chibur and Tshuva? So the Rambam. The Rambam says, as mentioned, one of the more famous Rambams, the Rambam is based on the Gemara. The Rambam says at the beginning of Perek Beis, Ezehi Tshuva Gemura, right? What exactly is complete Tshuva? So Zeshebo Liyado Dover, it's the Rambam that everyone here knows, a person that Ba Liyado Dover She'avar Ba, he had already violated a sin, V'yefshir B'yado La'asoso, he could violate the sin again, U'peirish V'lo Asim Neha Tshuva, Lo Meyir V'lo Meyikishlan Koach, he completely lets that Aveira pass. So Ketzad, so Hari Sheba Al Isha Ba'Aveira, he had an inappropriate relationship in the past. Uliachar Zman is Yachid Imav who owe me Bava, so he still loves her. Ubikoch Gufo, Ubudina Shavarba, he's back in the same place, the same hotel, the same this, the same that. Upirishlo Avar is about Tshuva Gemura. And he was Poresh, that's about Tshuva Gemura. Husha Shlomo Amar Vizakhas Barakhav Mebakur Zekha. Adashar lo yavo yimeharaa. The person says, I'm so much a different person that I don't have any sort of even desire for the same thing again. But that is what you call, again, second level, second order type of change, as opposed to first order change. And whatever it is that any of us want to work on, it's not enough of saying, okay, I'm not going to do something, but it's a matter of looking at the totality of a person and to figure out what's going on. Okay, everyone hear that? Fine. Just number three. The modern trend in, I guess, psychology, at least that I've seen before, and again, in 12-step programs that have been effective in bringing about change on a mass level. Anybody know what the first 12-step program was? AA. Now, what's that? AA. So AA started out as a couple guys, crazy people in Akron, Ohio, back in the 1930s, I believe, in ways of dealing with alcoholism. And since then, AA is found just, you know... The AA book has been printed. Yeah,
it was based on Jungian
psychology. Right, correct. But it's been like AA, and then that gave birth to like 1,000 other 12-step programs. Now there's a 12-step program for, you know, any possible thing you find a 12-step program for. And the basic idea of the 12-step program in modern psychology is that you really can't, if a person has a serious problem in their life, right? And when we say a serious problem, the person sort of has to know what is a minor problem that a person can sort of deal with head-on, face-on, counteract, sort of, you know, in a head-on type of way. I think about any issue you might have versus something that is far more ingrained, far more perhaps already an addictive issue. So the basic idea of the 12-step programs was that if a person, let's say, is an addict, a person is an alcoholic, a person is a drug addict, a person is a sex addict, a person is a gambler, just to say, I'm not going to do it, and I promise I'm not going to do it, and this great show of willpower, and I've been having this issue, I'm going to keep on promising myself, I'm not, it will never, ever, ever be effective for a person who has a true ingrained problem. Now, if your willpower is enough, So then that's not who we're talking about. We're not talking about the person who just happens to enjoy, you know, a cigarette, you know, once every period of time, and when he wants to stop, he stops. We're speaking about a person, probably that all of us have something in our life. There's some people that have real addictive tendencies, and just willpower there is not enough. Now, that same idea is seen as well, you may know, sort of like a Jewish, sort of like a comparable idea, either in Chazal or the Rishonim. Okay, so the way, so I apologize, right, so the way then of a person changing a habit, let's say in 12-step programs, is really through surrendering to God, but it's through changing, you know, sort of the entire context of a person's life. To say, I'm no longer going to do X, that's not effective. A person has to create an entire life of A, surrender, of letting God sort of be part of that process, but B, of sort of changing the nature of a person's life, changing the context of a person's life. That's something that's seen very, very much as well in the Rishonim. It's seen in the Rambam, it's seen in Rabbi Yona. The Gemara tells us that there are certain things that the that sort of counteract the Gzar Din. So one of those things is Shino Hashem, you change your name. Some people say it's Shino Hamakom, you change your place. I used to sit over here, now I'm going to sit over there, right? What does that mean, a Shino Hamakom? What was that, a joke? You know, I move 30 feet over and now I'm going to be like a different person, and that's the mechanism of repentance? So maybe, I don't mean to make a joke, I'm sort of imagining, Avi, no offense, but our shul, sometimes like changing a makom next to, you know, a talking section to a non-talking section, maybe sometimes that in itself is a huge, huge mila, as a no offense to KBY, which is a great shul, but sometimes like a shino makom itself is enough. But the Maharsha points out in that Gemara Rosh Hashanah that it's not really about sort of a change of name. It's like a whole change of context, a change of how a person views themselves, who they associate with, who they're around, where they are, what's the nature of their life, and all those ideas in Chazal or sort of such a way of saying, sometimes direct change is not effective, but I have to sort of make all the periphery changes, and those periphery changes can sort of slowly change a new sort of dynamic in a person's life. Okay, just mentioned very briefly a fourth comparable idea. The modern ideas in psychology is that a person often, when they're really, really struggling, they're really suffering from an issue, so they often can't deal with that issue themselves. Again, taking the classic ideas of trying to lose weight, trying to exercise, trying to change a real midah, trying to change an addiction. Right? There, it's almost impossible that a person deals with themselves. And even the change in psychotherapy is that if you go to a psychotherapist and you're paying that guy, anybody know how much a good therapist costs, roughly? You don't have to talk from your own experiences. Well, then, you know, 150, okay. 150 would be a guy somewhere in, you know, in Iowa. I mean, or, you know, somewhere in the boroughs. But, you know, you go to Manhattan, you charge, you know, some fancy schmancy guy for $300 or $400 on the West Side, he'll still say, you know what, this is not enough, but you really have to connect to a group. You have to connect to a group setting about most of the major issues in life, learning of Vad Musar. So Revolbi, but he really came before Revolbi, said you want to change a midah in your life, you know, don't sit in the corner and take out, you know, Mesilas Yesharim. Okay, that's nice, but that's not really what a person needs. But you sit down with a Vada people, four, five, six, seven people, you talk about an issue, this is what I was dealing with, that's what you're dealing with, this is that, how can we be mechazik each other? The entire sort of, and Revolbi, as everyone knows, himself was trained in psychology, but the entire movement in psychotherapy, psychology, is not the one-on-one, it's not the personal experience, but it's really the group dynamic. Now that's something that already is seen in the Gemara, it's seen in the Rishonim, the power of a tzibur, the power of coming into a tzibur to confess one's sins in the tzibur, in the context of people who are there. The very idea of the Rambam that says by the Serah Mishtaleach, by the goat that's been sent out, that even if a person doesn't do tshuva, but he's included with the Serah Mishtaleach, that is mechaper, that atones for mitzvahs kalos, right? And the idea being, again, Rav Soloveitchik explains beautifully, that sometimes the tshuva comes because of the personal experience, because of the personal redemptive experience. Sometimes tshuva comes about because of being part of a group, and a group going through something, a group changing, etc. So this sort of modern prevalent idea in psychology of the power of the group is something already that we see back in the time of the Rambam and back in the time of the Gemara. Okay, any thoughts until now? So we spoke about the process of tshuva, where Machlokes Rishonim is the first piece, the psychological, the emotional, the harata piece, or is the first piece the change, or the Rambam who said the first piece is the change. The second thing that we said that in order to change, you need the totality of a person, we need sort of second order type of change. We mentioned the value of a group. We said that often behavior can't be changed directly, it has to sort of be changed through changing a context. Okay, anybody have any thoughts, questions, reflections? Okay, let's mention a few more ideas, and then we will conclude. So there's a very important discussion of how to bring about change in another person. There's someone by the name of Jerome Frank. I actually have a personal connection with him. My father is a psychologist, and Jerome Frank was his advisor when my father got his doctorate a couple years ago. But Jerome Frank is a very, very well-known person in psychotherapy, and he discussed that if you want to help bring about change in another person, so it really requires three things. The first thing is that the helper and the helpee need to be on the same page. Right? You have a person in your life, the person drinks too much, okay? And you go to them, and you tell them, you know, we can't deal with the drinking anymore, but that person is not looking for it, he's not looking for change, he's not looking for help, right? You tell a person, you know, whatever muster you want to give someone, but that person's out to lunch, right? This is like the proverbial, you know, rabbi getting up to give muster about people talking in shul. Who cares? I mean, you know, I don't want to hear it, I don't really feel like something I have to change. My father spoke in shul, my grandfather spoke in shul. There's a big shul in New Jersey. I don't know if I should give any details of this or not. Right? So this is sort of gives you like an insight into like the challenge of the rabbinate. The rabbinate is the greatest profession, but you have to know sometimes when you deal with people that the helpee and the helpee be on the same page. So this shul in New Jersey was building a beautiful, beautiful new shul. And this shul has a kiddush club, and this kiddush club is like, you know, Halacha Moshe Sinai. It's been there forever. It's quite popular. People come to shul specifically to make sure on time for the kiddush club. So when they were doing construction, they put up a tent instead of the shul. And the rabbi thought, okay, this is my big chance. You know, the shul's gone. We have a tent. This is our, this is it. So rabbi gets up and says, you know, we have a tent now. We don't have a shul. This is the opportunity. Everyone can hear Haftorah instead of coming for the kiddush club. A guy calls up the rabbi, says, Rabbi, I need to meet with you. He comes in, he starts to cry. He said, Rabbi, my father was in the Kiddush Club, and my grandfather was in the Kiddush Club, and this is why my love, and this is why I'm excited to come to shul, and you want to take away my connection to Yadus. Anyway, so the rabbi sort of realized that to some degree you're sort of talking different languages. You know, the rabbi's talking in the language of, you know, Kavod Beis HaKnesses, and speaking about the greatness of the Haftorah, and speaking about this, and no, and Gemals, and another person sort of looking at things totally differently. So anytime you want to deal with someone, there's sort of the necessity of making that the helper and the helpee be on the same page. Dr. Frank describes it sort of like a person who's a Boy Scout helping an old lady cross the street, but in the wrong direction. You know, you want to sort of help out, but you're crossing them in the totally wrong direction. That's number one. Number two is that the person who's the helping person has to be genuinely empathetic and warm, right? If you have, again, sort of like a shul rabbi or a rebbe, and the rebbe gets up and he's like fire and brimstone, and the talmidim don't really think as though the rebbe cares about him, so how are you going to be an effective person in my life in regards to change? If a person ever goes to a therapist, and as I'm sure some of you have and probably will in the future, it's always great to sort of check in with people here and there, and you feel the person is checked out, the person's not an empathetic person, you feel you're talking to them and they're looking elsewhere, so that person might be the most qualified person, but unless you feel the person's empathetic and warm, it's not going to happen. And lastly, which is the challenge for most parents, is to focus on the behavior, not on the person, right? If you ever try speaking to your kids, and you tell your kids, well, you're this, right? And you're never going to be that, or you're always that, or you're that, or you're blah, 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 all the things that parents can tell kids, you want to say, focus on this specific behavior, right? So again, the helper and the helpee are on the same page, empathetic and warm, focusing on behavior. And then if you sort of think about this list of people, so it's no wonder that parents and kids, you know, always speak past each other. It's no wonder that, you know, you're trying to give a chabur and so I kolel, and this kid is over here. Why people are talking past each other? Because things are often done out of anger, or it's focusing on the person, it's not focusing on behavior. Okay, so the way if you go through in Chazal, sort of using Dr. Frank as almost like a paradigm, so in Chazal, it seems as though change comes about really in one of two ways when it comes to another person. So one way that it comes about, and by the way, if you think about, anybody have like a good paradigm for different models of sort of change of person changing and how other people are involved? So we think about the Mishnah, the Emseches Yuma, of Mi Mitare Eschem, who is Mitare you, right? So either the process there is the Tahara Bibachutz, sort of the water being sprinkled on the person, or the Mikvah Yisrael. Either someone else is bringing about the Tahara, the Kohen comes and sprinkles water on the person, or the person themselves dives into the Mikvah. Now that same idea is found in Chazal. The same idea is found just in psychology. Person A could change person B, but it often can't be direct, it can't be confrontational, it can't often be mussary, it can't be with anger, it can't be... Usually the effect of one person to another often has to be indirect, subtle, with warmth, in a certain type of way. Well, let me tell you a great example. Speaking about shuls and kiddush clubs. Right, many years ago, the OU decided to adopt either a policy or adopt an idea of putting a kibosh on the kiddush clubs. Right, and you can imagine the uphill battle being fought over such a thing. I think Rabbi Billet, I know a lot of you davening in the Yangtze Woodmere, I think Rabbi Billet was the original person. There was a big issue of drinking in the shul, and the Simchas Torah was out of hand, and things were just out of hand, and it was around that time also where there was an increase of teenage kids drinking. So Rabbi Billet said there's not going to be any alcohol in the shul, and I respect him enormously for taking a position that he knew that he would get attacked by, you know, 700 rabid people about that position. Anyway, so when the OU came out of that position, there was a certain rub in the OU who was working on this policy. The president of a major shul in New York called up the OU and said, you know, how dare you, you know, get involved in our issues, and we should be able to self-modulate, and we're adults, and the answer is not to outlaw something, the answer is to educate, and the guy really gave him like a real mishaberach, this president of the shul, to this person. Anyway, that Motzei Shabbos, the president of the shul goes with his 15-year-old son to the Knicks game in Madison Square Garden, and none of you have kids. It's always like a dicey proposition taking your teenage kids. My son and I went to the Mets game a couple weeks ago. We love going. We're Mets fans, etc. But you know, you never know what you're going to hear, especially if you buy the tickets that I buy. You know, if you buy the $300 tickets, maybe it's like a classier operation. But you know, so you want to sort of enjoy things that are mutter, you can bond over. But it's just, you know, you're just... I'll tell you one nice thing about Nachas, by the way, that I should really get moving, but my son and I went to a Mets game many years ago, and many of you know my son Tani, and he was maybe 9-10 years old, and then they put on like a video of what they usually have like in the middle of the game, yeah, whatever, you know what I'm talking about. So I have him, so I sort of glance up for a second, see if it was over, and my son grabs me, he's like, Abba, that's not for us. And I'm like, yes, like one of those great moments of chinuch of your kids. Anyway, so they go to Madison Square Garden, and the three people like cursing like sailors in front of them, and they were drinking, and they were this, and then, and the father tells the son, he said, ach, you see what happens, you know, when people drink, and how disgusting. And the son said, Abba, no offense, but that's what you and your friends look like at the kiddush club on Shabbos. Right? So the president calls up the guy, the rally for OU, and says, you know what, I'm so sorry. He says, I think you're right. If you would get the mussar directly, if the rabbi would get up and give mussar, it would be completely, you know, ineffective. But if sort of in a roundabout type of way, so that change comes about, but it's often not direct, and the person has to sort of keep that in mind when they deal with people. I'll tell you a very prevalent example that unfortunately shul rabbanim always deal with, and that is the idea of having battered women. Right? Battered women, and we live in Muncie, we've had, I'll even give you a sense of the problems in Klal Yisrael, they have in Muncie and other communities, they have shelters for firm women, right, that they can come, because, you know, take a Hasidish woman and you put her in the sort of the general population shelter, she would never go, and kosher food and all those other things that go on. The shelter is always filled, and my wife and I end up having sort of people over our house because there's not enough room in this very, very large shelter for all the women to have to, unfortunately, take advantage. Now,
people who know about issues dealing with battered women. So you can't really tell a woman directly you have to leave the husband, because the woman's already battered. The woman already feels she can't live without the husband. Maybe she lives in fear of the husband. She's in a weird way dependent on the husband. The husband often, who's a batterer, is often a very charismatic person. The woman has become sort of beaten down and she's meek. If you ever try to tell a woman, this guy is trouble and you have to leave him, 99 out of 100 times, she's going to run back to the husband, feel that the husband is being attacked, come to his defense, etc. How do women always leave their husbands? Anybody want to venture a guess? Because a young child will tell the mother, you know, mommy, I can't watch you anymore suffering this way. I can't see you with a bruise on your face. It's almost like that side voice that's coming. So keeping in mind like the paradigm of Dr. Frank, it's not confrontational, it's not direct, it's with empathy. The helper and the helpee are, you know, ultimately on the same page. And that's always sort of the essence of tshuva. Okay, where do we see that idea in Chazal? Anybody want to maybe mention like a famous idea in the Gemara? Probably what's the most famous paradigm of a chozer b'tshuva? What's that? Elazar ben Dudai. Right? Elazar ben Dudai, it's not even like a Gemara you would speak about. You know, it's like one of those like many Gemaras in Shas that you wouldn't talk about if it wasn't like a Gemara. You know, but Elazar ben Dudai was a person, he was like a famous mushchas. You know, literally, he was like a world-class mushchas, a world-class avarian. He had met every single zona, and he finally found out about a certain zona across the ocean who would... Anyway, so in the midst of that interaction with the zona, the woman sort of laughs, and she says, oh, Elazar ben Dudai, you're probably never going to do tshuva, right? And that completely turned around his life. What's Gemara say about Elazar ben Dudai? So Yesh Kono Lama B'Sha'achas, he completely turned his life around. He died on the spot as a Chozer B'Tshuva. Now, if you imagine for a second, if this person giving Musar to Elazar ben Dudai was his father, his Rebbe, this person, yeah, it would never be effective. It was only because it was someone, there wasn't no Gei B'Davar, somebody who probably said it in this very sort of non-confrontational type of way, someone that got him at a moment of weakness, and that sort of has to be the model of tshuva for ourselves and for the people that we deal with. So that's one model. Other people bringing about change, but that has to be done in a very thoughtful way, in a very calm way, in a nachastic way. We have to find the right places, the right times to speak to our parents or siblings or children, whatever it is in our life we're trying to bring about change. Now the other way, of course, is the person himself who goes to a mikvah. The person himself who decides that he wants change. Now that often has to come about really once a person has had a moment where they recognize that they need to change, right? A person realizes that there has to be some type of change in their life. But again, it almost always has to come from one's own efforts, from one's own... one's own desire. Again, if it comes from somebody else, if it comes from a spouse, if it comes from... It's almost not effective. A person almost has to wake up one day and make a decision about change themselves. There's a very beautiful piece in Sichas Musar on Maimer Tzadi Gimel, those who want to look about this topic, about many Maimer Komas that effect. A person sort of has to hit rock bottom. They have to be in a place of darkness. Usually change, like real, real change from real problem, it's very hard for that to come about unless a person makes that decision himself. Let me tell you a very, very nice story, also sort of relating to shuls and communities. I heard a story from Dr. Pelkovitz. Dr. Pelkovitz, when he wrote this story, one of his books, he left out some of the details, so I will do so as well to not incriminate any potential guilty parties. But Dr. Pelkovitz has a relative living in a very, very large Jewish community. And Dr. Pelkovitz used to go visit this community, and Dr. Pelkovitz's his brother-in-law, right, he has a lot of brother-in-laws, and his friends were what you would call in, I guess, the parlance of the shul, like the backbenchers. You know, the backbenchers, you know, like in every single circumstance in life, there's always a backbencher, you know, offense to Ellie and Simon and Gedalia. The backbencher, a guy who comes in, they sit in the back corner, they want to be, you know, left alone, they want to talk, they're not like, they're trying to disengage themselves. He used to be a Rebbe in high school. So you always knew the first day who would be the five guys who come in the first day, and they would sit in the back corner, and they're making a statement. And Dr. Pelkovitz's brother-in-law and their friends, they would come in, and just talking nonstop from start to finish. The rabbi would get up on the verge of tears, he would yell at them, the talking would stop for about, 6 seconds, and then it would go back full force afterwards. Anyway, came the next year, these people had started a new shul, because I think people had moved, and it was too far of a walk, and the shul broke up. Dr. Pelkovitz came in, sat down next to his brother-in-law, and you could hear a pin drop. And Dr. Pelkovitz said, guys, what's going on? They're like, shh, shh, they're shushing him. And he thought maybe in between Aliyahs who'd asked them, they said, shh, no, there's absolutely no talking in the shul. So Dr. Pelkovitz, on the way home from shul, asked brother-in-law, what in the world? This is like the biggest, sort of turnabout from one side to another. He said, we have to start a new shul. And we have to start a new shul. We asked ourselves, what do we really want from a shul? Right? We got into like a certain behavior pattern over the course of 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Starting a new shul made us almost, confront ourselves, made us almost sort of go back to the haschala and the language of Maharal when it comes to tshuva. Really ask ourselves, what are we trying to build? What are we trying to create? Once we did that, we realized that it really was important for us to have a shul without talking for ourselves and for our children, for the community, etc. We wrote up a contract. You can only be part of the shul if you're not going to talk in shul. Now that's an example of a person who brought about change, but that can only come about because of a change in thinking, a change of circumstance, a new beginning. That can't really come about because someone's forcing you, someone's yelling at you. That change, sort of in the eyes of Chazal, in the eyes of psychology as well, that has to be very, very self-originated. Okay, just two last things. The one is a very famous discussion in Rav Kook. People want to see this inside. Rav Kook has this in Urat HaTshuva and Perek Beis. You can see it in the Rambam, in the Mabit, in the Mabit, you can take a look at the Tshuva Pitomit versus Tshuva Dargit in the Chelek Beis. What's that?
You want it?
No, we have a copy here, but thank you, I appreciate it. The Mabit has a sefer also called Beis Elokim, where he has a whole discussion about Tshuva as well. And that is that while in Chazal, there's this idea of Yesh Kono Lomo B'Sha'achas, a person who says, I'm changing my entire life. Right? You ever sort of, this to some degree, for many years, I'm not sure it's still true anymore, this was like the phenomenon in Eretz Yisrael. Right? Now you'd see somebody in September, hanging out by the bar, and then you'd see them in January, they were no longer Fred, they were now, Michal Yosef Dov, you can't even recognize them. Their tzitzis are like going down to their calves, and that's a person, to some degree, is yesh kono lomo b'sha'achas. Okay, that person who's kono lomo, a person who makes a very sudden change. And the reality is that Chazal sort of discusses that type of change, sort of like the sudden change. If you look in Rav Kook, for instance, so he says there's two different types of tshuva. There's tshuva pitomit, tshuva that is moved by inspiration, by like a lightning bolt, by a flash, by a need of an absolute change, right? And there might be a place for that as well. And then there's tshuva dargit, a person who says, I'm 21 years old, let me by the age of 30 have worked on, a certain midah, let me work on this quality or that quality, or by the age I get to 40 or by 50, etc., etc. Rav Kook says that while the first is more attractive, and sometimes the first is necessary, meaningful tshuva is the tshuva dargit. And for us not to be somehow swayed or somehow convinced that like in a moment, if we're not a totally different person, if we're not an ish acher, we're not a totally different individual, then the tshuva is not meaningful. It's not true. Now if you go through the Rambam, it's mentioned briefly, the Rambam seems to talk a lot about this topic. Person's an ish acher, and God can testify that he's not going to go back to the chait. But even the Rambam would admit that really a meaningful tshuva, although it might be spurned on by that initial firebolt, needs to sort of happen over a period of time, and to allow ourselves that. To not look at ourselves and say, I'm nobody, I'm nothing. Right? And I can't believe I went back to certain behavior. Look at yourself now at 20, 21, 22, 23, versus 2 years ago, or 4 years ago, or 5 years ago, both in regards to learning and in life, and to realize that real change is a very gradual process, and that's only part of what the psychologists speak about, and what the Baal Mutzar speak about, is this sort of extensive, expansive change. Now let me just say this one last thing, and then we'll wrap up. There's been a major, major change in psychotherapy and psychology. Anybody wants to see a lot of discussion on this? There's somebody by the name of David Rosmarin. Anybody hear him, David Rosmarin? He's a firm guy. He got his PhD in Harvard, and his field is how religion and spirituality affects psychology, psychotherapy, real change in a person. Where that used to be like two totally different worlds. You know, that a psychologist would never speak about, you know, being God-centered and spirituality and spiritual growth and spiritual health. It just would not be part of like the mantra of psychologists. If anything, the most famous psychologists were virulently, A, they were Jewish, and they were virulently like a good secular Jew could only be. You know, the people who can be like the most passionately anti-religious would often be Jews, and often Jews actually grew up from, but virulently anti sort of the role of God in this process. Exactly. The modern day change, and this is not across the board, but it's definitely prevalent in 12-step programs. And I keep going back to 12-step programs because the real change in the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years is psychologists realizing that for real behavioral change, just therapy is not enough. You need some model of like a 12-step program. That 12-step program is all about a connection to God, surrendering to God, developing real spirituality, working on one's, you know, character traits as a way of sort of spiritual development, bringing God into every person, part of a person's life. And by doing that, so then a person just becomes like an ishacher. A person becomes transformed by now not being centered on the person, but centered on a relation with God. And that's something that obviously was always sort of bread and butter of a Jewish approach, returning to God, making God a center, a faith-based approach to change. That's become the norm as well in other areas of psychology. Okay, so I mentioned like a lot of different pieces. I just mentioned them briefly. Again, stages of change, how perhaps a Jewish perspective, which emphasizes the change first, the charata later, might be different. Number two, meaningful change has to be the totality of a person, what we would call second-order change as opposed to first-order change. Number three, often to just with one's will to tackle a problem is not enough, as we see in modern psychology, but it's also true in Chazal, and all the various changes that a person makes around a problem, which is often meaningful, a context, a community, a name, a place, etc. The idea of a connection to its seaboard that elevates a person, that a person can't change themselves. Number five, we spoke about the idea of various motivations for tshuva. Either comes from a third party, but very indirectly, gently, warmly, lovingly, not confrontationally, or has to come from a person themselves. We spoke about gradual versus sudden change, Rav Kook, the Ma'abit, and the Rambam, etc. And lastly, the role of God in all of that. Let me just mention, by the way, just end with a beautiful medrash that I love. This idea can be found in Avos Rabbi Nosson, and also in the Medrash HaGadol and other places as well, and is the change about Rabbi Akiva. Now, how Rabbi Akiva became Rabbi Akiva is a sort of a big source of debate in the Midrashim. What inspired Rabbi Akiva? Anybody know, by the way, who else sort of has a similar confusion about their trajectory in growth or coming to God? Anybody? So by Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu, we don't know how old he was and what brought about that change. I mean, it's a fascinating topic. You know, what stage of life was Avraham in when he sort of discovered HaKadosh Baruch Hu? But by Rabbi Akiva as well, so the version that's brought down over Rabbi Nosson is that Rabbi Akiva saw the rock, and the rock had the water which made an indentation on the rock. And Rabbi Akiva realized that if water, which is soft, can affect a rock, which is hard, so Torah, which is like iron, Torah, which is hard, so Alachas Kamakama, the effect it should be able to have on a person's heart. And he went to his wife. The best thing a person can ever do is to marry the right person. That's like the biggest choice that a person makes. And so everything else is sort of like, you know, second, third, or 20th tiers after that. And his wife says to go to the Beis Medrash. Rabbi Akiva says, the Beis Medrash, 40 years old, to walk into the Beis Medrash, I'm so embarrassed. So Rachel said, no, the example she gave, she found a donkey that had like an indentation in his back. And she put dirt on the back of the donkey and then planted something in that dirt. So you have like a plant coming out of the back of the donkey. The donkey walked into the shuk. And the first time people saw it, you know, a donkey walks in with like a plant growing on their back. People were cracking up. They were aghast. They were... Second time again, the same reaction. By the third or fourth time already, hey, that was the donkey with the plant growing out of the back. So Rachel said, you know, you try it also as well. You try the change. You'll be laughed at. It'll be difficult. You'll come back. You'll be laughed at again. It'll be difficult. But eventually that becomes sort of like the new normal in a person's life. The Mussar and the Medrash, both as far as what Rabbi Akiva himself understood and the message that his wife imparted to him, really is from that same message. Change comes about in a psychologically healthy way. Change comes about through repeated behavior. Change comes about often slowly, often painstakingly, often over a long period of time. By person doing that, that's a person becomes Rabbi Akiva. And that's sort of the real answer to what I began with about an hour ago. The frustration, the depression of change, A, can sometimes be dealt with if a person understands the need of being God-centered, changing actions, having a group, all the various things we mentioned, but a lot more also. But a person also recognizes, you know what, I'm 20 years old now, my goal is that by age 85, when I'm stopping working, I'm in retirement, I want to be a certain type of person. Let me go through sort of that gradual but meaningful transformation in my own life and be able to look back with that sense of pride over a period of time. I think that's the sort of the genuinely Jewish approach, and hopefully something that's meaningful for you, hopefully meaningful for me, and we can all gradually but meaningfully continue to make very, very real changes in our life. Amen. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you.
I think it's important to mention that that tomorrow's that Yom Kippur is Freud's Yahrzeit.
Right. Yep.